Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today, earlier today, we had the solstice rising. So not only a happy Christmas, but also a very happy solstice. And the solstice is a very special one for a number of reasons. And depending on where in the world you are, it's been slightly differently. But here in California, it's been a very special one. Here in California and pretty much everywhere, the news is that this isn't just the solstice, the winter solstice, but it's also a full moon and in parts of the world, a lunar eclipse as well. So lots of things happening. And with this news, I give you over to resident astrologer Kathleen McGowan.
It is really an extraordinary day for so many reasons. There was a full lunar eclipse last night. It was visible from much of North America. I know some of our friends in Europe only got to see pieces of it. Unfortunately, here in the normally sunny city of Los Angeles, we have had a 10-year record of rain. So it was too cloudy for us to see the eclipse, but we were certainly able to feel the eclipse. It's been such an extraordinary time energetically. And so we really wanted to focus on this today. We wanted to talk about some of the shifting that's happening. We wanted to do a little bit of a wrap-up of 2010, of what kind of a year it's been, of what we're hearing from people about the things that have gone on this year, hopes for the future, and where all this takes us spiritually, astrologically, astronomically, all of those things. What made today extremely interesting, and I actually hadn't looked at it quite from this point of view until I received an email this week from, there's a lovely yoga studio here in Los Angeles called Golden Bridge. And they do some really beautiful releases when they talk about energy. And by releases, I mean press releases, emails, that type of thing. And they sent something out this week about the energy of this particular solstice event. So whereas a lot of us were certainly looking at the fact that it was a full lunar eclipse on the winter solstice, which is an extremely powerful event. And we'll talk about why that is on its own in a moment. But what they reminded us of at Golden Bridge was it was more than just that. It was that in terms of how it also aligned up towards galactic center and the dark rift, which if you're familiar with the 2012 phenomena, that is what we're talking about. We're talking about a particular alignment, which I'm going to let Philip explain for a moment, about how this relates to 2012. And so when you put it all together, what we ended up happening, the solstice has scrambled my brain today because it's so energetically powerful. What's happened here is we've had an alignment that happens only every 200,000 years. So today really is an extraordinary day.
Absolutely. And we are, of course, today, 2 years, rather, precisely away from that magical date of 2012, the winter solstice, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, of December 2021, where we have the end of the Mayan calendar. And for the likes of John Major Jenkins, who we had the pleasure of spending a day with in Denver at a Writer's Grail workshop just 2 weeks ago, John is the one who has identified the fact that the Mayan calendar isn't just a standalone calendar with kind of like, you know, just ticking over, but actually that it has an astronomical and an astrological foundation. And that astronomical foundation is this galactic alignment. Now, the galactic alignment is basically when on the winter solstice, as the sun rises, as it rises behind the sun, sits the galactic center. And this is a very slow movement. And simply because of the diameter of the sun, this takes several years. In fact, it takes as much as 10, 20, 30, depending on how precisely you want to measure this event. And basically, the center of it is 2012, but it is happening years on either side. And basically, from a purely visual point of view, without the high-tech aids which we are using and which the minds may have had, or at least were aware of how to calculate it precisely, we are already visually within that galactic center. So from a purely visual point of view, the galactic alignment is now, if you want.
And so, where does this lead us energetically? What's going on? Well, the winter solstice is always an interesting period, and we're certainly going to look at that historically. But it's this idea that, in the northern hemisphere, it is the winter solstice. It's the shortest day of the year and the longest night. But that means that starting tomorrow, that begins to change. So in essence, it becomes the rebirth of the light. Light begins to grow tomorrow. And so for the ancients, and certainly for many people of spirit in the modern world who recognize the seasons and who are trying to at least stay conscious of some of the earth-based traditions and astronomically based traditions, it's always had this essence of the dawn that will come after the dark. And in the Celtic tradition, which I was raised in, it was also a major time of releasing. It was a major time of letting go. It was time to process everything that had happened to you in the previous cycle and release everything that didn't serve you. And we're going to talk about this. There are a number of different a number of different ceremonies and processes and things that you can do if you want to capture the energy of the winter solstice. And by the way, if you're listening to this show, because we do tape and we become available in the archives, if you're listening to the show on the 22nd or the 23rd or even through Christmas, you don't have to do these ceremonies or these releasing opportunities actually on the day. There is a whole orb of energy that comes with this idea of the winter solstice, with this idea of releasing, and you can do this, all the way through the new year.
In fact, one of the most popular places to go is probably Newgrange, in Ireland, because of the phenomena there of the winter solstice. But again, solstice comes from the point of view that the sun's movements slow down. And so what is visible today is very much visible tomorrow and was visible yesterday and even a few days on either side, because it is this kind of slowing down of the sun phenomenon. So again, as with the 2012 phenomenon, now is good enough, and tomorrow will be good enough as well.
Solstice actually means that the sun stands still, because that's what the ancients believed. And it is true about Newgrange. In fact, I've tried for many, many years to become one of those lucky lottery winners. There's actually a lottery you can put in your name with Newgrange for the lottery every year to be allowed into the Newgrange Monument so you can watch the extraordinary solar phenomenon that happens there on December 21st. But alas, I have not yet been picked, and so we can watch it online and have done that. But one of the things I did learn the last time I was in Newgrange and had a really long conversation with one of the caretakers there is that you actually can observe this solar phenomenon for 17 days on either side of the solstice. It's not as perfect as it is at the moment of the solstice, but there are versions of it. And that's a reminder that this energy of clearing out and bringing the light in is available to all of us. And just one of the things that I have done for many, many years, it was passed on to me from some Irish friends, was at the end of the year, and I'm going to do this tonight, at the end of the year, write down all of the things that have happened to you this year that you don't want to hold on to. This is something that happened that I want to let go of and I don't want to bring with me into the new year. And so you make a list of those things that you are truly ready to let go of and release. And of course, the idea is write them down, say, I'm ready to get rid of these and release them with love. You have to bless the lessons that you learn from it and let it go. But then you burn them any way you want, in the fireplace, in a bonfire, just be safe. But the idea is to burn the paper and allow yourself that feeling of freedom and watching it disintegrate and go away, and feeling the lightness of it as you eliminate those burdens from your life, knowing that you're about to move into this new stage, allowing more light into your life because the light can now pour into your spirit since you have let go of these things that have maybe darkened your experience from the last year.
And this transition period, and when I wrote The New Pyramid Age, I began to very much write it as a series of, okay, let's look at the pyramids and let's discuss them in Egypt, let's discuss them. But as I was investigating and as I was finding out what the latest research was about all of these pyramids, the one overarching principle was that pyramids came with rejuvenation, with regeneration, with closing one period of time and embracing the new one. And one of the things which I am very much interested in is the 2012 phenomenon. And one message which I try to get into the 2012 phenomenon is that we actually know what's going to happen in 2012 when we look at like the Mayan calendar, kind of like, you know, people kind of like the one thing which the New Age industry so abuses and which I so hate is the fact like the Mayans knew something about 2012, but we do not know what it is. They don't know what it is either. And then they paint their own picture as to what the 2012 phenomenon is. Well, the Mayans know what the 2012 phenomenon is, and they have recorded it for hundreds of years. It's part of the parcel. You know, the Mayans weren't stupid. They just didn't say, hey, we know 2012 is important, but we have no idea why. That's simply impossible. So they knew what 2012 was all about, and it's a very long story, which I won't do, but it comes down to this transitioning, and it is precisely that. It's letting go of the old times, coming together as a nation, and obviously not, you know, 20 million, but representative leaders of each tribe, of each aspect of the Mayan world and the Mayan civilization, and deciding the fate for the new world. And literally the fate for the new world was a mission statement. What are we going to do within the next X amount of years? And they broke it down, the next 80 years, the next 20 years, then the consecutive 20 years. So they gave themselves specific challenges. And they built pyramids, they built monuments in Chichen Itza, which were visual reminders to them of kind of like what they had decided to do. So they always knew, whenever they looked at it, that what mission they were on now and where they were with those plans. And again, this was looking towards the future, but they also looked towards the past. But they pretty much said, hey, the past is in the past, can't change it. We can wipe the slate clean, which is basically why the Mayan calendar starts back from 00000, because in their minds they were washing the slate clean, and which is why we have the January 1st effect, whereby, hey, the New Year celebrations are so powerful.
And that's part two of this ceremony, this Celtic ceremony that I have practiced for many, many years, is after you have done the release, then you write down what you would like to replace that space with in your life, the beautiful things, the exciting things, the things that you really want to accomplish and achieve. And this really is the essence of where New Year's resolutions come from. This idea of working through these solstice rituals, that's the root of them. So I offer that up to you if that sounds like something that's fun for you to do, or productive for you to do. It really feels good, and it's a great thing. And what I would also challenge you is, you know, back to what Philip was just saying, you know, in the Mayan spirit of things, in the Celtic spirit of things, in the spirit of ancient wisdom in all cultures, use this period of winter as a period of knowledge. It's really about introspection. This is the period of getting deep into who you are and why you're here. And those are the things I would challenge you to create for your New Year's resolutions, not just how much weight you want to lose or what new job you want. All that's great, and believe me, I, you know, the weight loss is high on my chart for 2011. But it's really about, what am I here to do? Why am I here? And what is my mission? And what is my promise? And what have I come here to do? And how do I move toward that goal of fulfilling my mission in life, my purpose? You know. And that is, I think, those, I think, are the real powerful resolutions for the new year. And coming back to the 2012 phenomenon, depending on who you talk to, there has been this, 2012 isn't just a single year. The phenomenon is not about a year. It's about a period. And it is about this closing time period. And depending on who you talk to, it's from 1980 to 2016 is basically the range. More specifically, like 93 to 2012, 2013, that period, that this is the end of a cycle and that we are coming to the end of that cycle. And the most important thing we can do right now is understand what have we learned and where are we going from there? Because we really are being given an extraordinary opportunity to start anew. And I think that what we need to be doing right now, especially because this has been such a harsh year for so many people, we need to seize these opportunities for moving forward in a positive place in the future and really allowing ourselves to let go of everything that has been divisive and dark and difficult in these last years.
Absolutely. And, you know, my part of the Spirit Revolution's message, Christmas address to the leaders of the world, if you want, is basically this. And I think a lot of the frustration, you know, we're great watchers of The Daily Show, and we have, you know, we love the way Jon Stewart has to be the core gesture as to what's going on. And we quite often kind of like say, what is the world, the state of this world? Kind of like, you know, it's supposed to be something which it appears to be not to be the case. But as I've been kind of like looking at the Mayan perspective as to what they perceive it to be, I actually kind of like feel that when you look at the world from 1993 to now, we have become a global village. Skype is probably the best summation in one word of how this has happened, whereby in 1993, you could hardly phone anybody without paying a second mortgage on your house if it was longer than 5 minutes, and now you can phone everybody. We have become a world village. The banking world has become a global, you know, a global enterprise. Everything is global. But unfortunately, certain institutions like politics and laws haven't caught up with this. So you have this strife and this outdated model, which is partially hanging on, but also partially simply not yet replaced, which is kind of like giving this massive bizarreness of kind of like, you know, massive outpourings, for example, of 9/11, but a superpower like America, unfortunately a 20th century superpower like America, which hasn't really adapted to the needs of the 21st century and is unable to kind of like do certain things which are very easy, but whereby they're trying to do it in ways that is still not of this world, or no longer of this world. And this is time and time again, when you look at the news, you kind of like see that there are things which are still not caught up. And I think this is kind of like, you know, my hope for 2011, at least, is that people are beginning to see that when things don't work out, they should try and do it in a new way rather than just trying to, you know, do it the old way. It's like, you know, if your car doesn't start, if you turn the key 50 times, the 51st time, it's not going to start. There's something wrong with your car. And just that people realize that and try to come up with new ways of doing things. And I think that's kind of like, you know, I think my overall message to myself and to everybody else of like, you know, try to do innovative ways, because that's kind of like, I think, where we are right now in this universe.
We have been talking a lot about the solstice this week on my Facebook page, where we have some very great conversations. And it was interesting because a lot of people came in and contributed their various solstice practices and their solstice experiences and things that they have been through on the solstice. And one of my Facebook friends, a lovely woman named Tina Carey, wrote on my Facebook that on the solstice, folks in Venezuela believe that the spirit of Christmas comes to Earth. To celebrate, they each write down 7 wishes for the world, 7 wishes for friends and family, and 7 wishes for themselves. The wishes are burned and then taken with the smoke up to the spirit of Christmas. I just thought that was really, really beautiful. I love the idea of having 7 wishes for the world and for friends as well as for yourself. And I am going to do that tonight because I think it's a really cool process. So I wanted to say thank you, Tina, for sending that in to us because I think it's really interesting and it's very, very positive in what can be a really heavy time. And we're going to transition to talk about the heaviness a little bit. One of the things I want to say is I personally feel a lot of anxiety this time of the year. And I know a lot of other people do too. And my point of view on that is I think it's because I think it's because in the Western world, we are battling nature. We are in this sort of frenetic holiday pace. We are Christmas shopping or having holiday parties or celebrating Hanukkah or all of the above. We are trying to work as fast as we can at work so that we have time to take off with our friends and our family for the holidays. We are in this constant state of of frantic. And if we observe the animal kingdom and nature around us, we see that that is not what we're supposed to be doing. You know, animals are hibernating. Bears are sleeping in the forest. Everything is dormant. Life is dormant, sleeping, relaxing, quiet. Things are becoming still in the natural world. And I think the fact that we are not in harmony with that is one of the reasons that there is so much anxiety and so much depression during the holidays. We are not in harmony with the earth. And so one of the things I really tried to do this year, because it's been such a crazy year already, is not be too frantic. I'm not making myself as crazy as I normally do. I'm not, you know, pushing myself to overachieve for the holidays. I'm trying to be a lot more in sync with the way things are, you know, in nature. And I think that if we all take a little bit more time to just stop and breathe and relax during the holidays, it's good for everybody. But 2010 has been a difficult year, and I can't tell you how much mail I get, how many Facebook posts I've seen, how many conversations I've had this year about how horrific 2010 has been. I think it has been a real, real time of purging and cleansing for so many. And I think that's beyond astrology. That's beyond, you know, individual lives and karma. I think it is part of this 2012 phenomenon. We are being pushed to change our lives, to clean up our act, to clean up the planet. And as a result, getting rid of those things that no longer serve us can be kind of a rocky and painful process.
Absolutely. And it goes back to one of the greatest sayings of all times, I think, is Carl Gustav Jung. And he actually said it when it came to the UFO phenomenon, which he saw as part of a far bigger picture. And that bigger picture was, in fact, the coming age, as he called it, of Aquarius, which is pretty much the same thing as the 2012 phenomenon. It's just been repackaged from the 1960s. And basically what Jung was saying was that as a world, we had two options. And each one of us and the world as a whole is a combination of these two. One of them was that we would willingly embrace change. And then the change would come, obviously, because we've willingly embraced it and we're working towards it. However, if you are not embracing it, then the archetypes of this world, of this universe, would basically make sure it happened. So it's kind of like resistance is futile. So he kind of like described how these two forces, free will and basically predetermination, are working together, because this is the order of the universe. This is the way this game has been designed and the way this game is being played and the way this game has been played for thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. And I think that is what is going on as well. It's like, you know, when you're saying anxiety is obviously because even though you are embracing change, there are still factors which is outside of everybody's control. And some of those outside factors are changing, or some of them aren't. Right now, life, we definitely don't feel privileged. We see it all around us. Is a factor of people who are being tested to their limits and sometimes beyond. And unfortunately, as we are seeing, people who are indeed deciding or unable to cope with the energies and the forces which are out there, and that is something else which we see, that unfortunately this world brings about an awful lot of people who are dying.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we are definitely experiencing in our own personal lives, and certainly around us. We are seeing a lot of people transitioning, passing, making the determination, either consciously or unconsciously, not to be here any longer. And that's been a harsh thing to live through this year, but specifically these last 2 weeks that we have, and a number of our friends have been surrounded by death and loss and illness in the last couple of weeks. And it's made me think a lot, and it's made me reflect a lot. And one of the things that I was thinking about is that a teacher I had in Ireland a number of years ago told me that the period of the winter solstice, the Celts believe that the period of the winter solstice is the time when it is easiest for souls to pass, that the reason that statistically more people die during the holidays is not because it's the holidays, but because it's the winter solstice. And on some greater unconscious level, our souls know that it is an easier and more gentle passing during this particular time of the year. Or certainly, at least, that's what a number of the ancients believed. And I think that so many of the things that we look at in the modern world go back to ancient wisdom. And I think that, you know, again, we say that people consciously or unconsciously do this. And in a lot of cases, it's just that, you know, people just do die at that time, and they don't consciously know that they're doing it. But on some soul level, as in terms of their own soul path, I think that they do know. So that has given me some comfort in these last couple of weeks. And sharing that with other people, I hope, has also given them comfort. What I always find amazing is when I say that, you know, there's always 3, 5, 10 people in the room, depending on where we are, that go, "Oh my gosh, I'm experiencing the same thing." I was doing an interview with a magazine a couple of days ago, and I made mention to the woman who was interviewing me. I said, "Oh gosh, you know, I'm a little bit frazzled. I'm sorry. Let me get my bearings. I've got a friend in the hospital with a brain tumor. We've had several deaths in the family in our immediate circle in the last week, and I'm just really, you know, sort of trying to get my arms around everything that's happening in the world right now. There seems to be so much loss and sickness." And she said, "Oh my God, I can't believe you just said that. I've lost 3 people in my immediate life in the last month or so." So I think a lot of people are feeling it. I think people are checking out, as it were, if they feel that they're done. What I have learned to do is pray for everybody's highest good. I mean, I'm all about prayer. I'm all about the power of prayer. But I used to pray for everyone to be healed. When someone was ill, my immediate prayer and, you know, the prayer process that I would go out and I'm on prayer lists. I'm part of prayer lists. I've led prayer lists and prayer groups was always for immediate healing or miraculous healing. And what I'm learning is that's not everybody's path. Everybody's path is not toward miraculous healing. And I've changed my prayer. And I had a very wise woman staying with me this week who really reinforced this when she said that her prayers are for everyone's highest good. And if that is for a peaceful transition, because it is the best for somebody's soul to leave now, then that's what we have to pray for. That some people aren't meant to have miraculous healing. Some people are meant to transition because that's part of their soul process, and it's possibly part of the process for the people around them as well. So I do take some comfort in that. For me, being able to let go is a big lesson. I want to save as much as I can, as many people as I can. I want to save people, and I want to save the world. And I know that that's always a big part of my personal anxiety. So when being able to step back just a little bit and say, you know what, sometimes it's about letting people go, and just being for them when they do that, has been a big lesson for me. And I think it is specifically a winter solstice lesson.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have gone to pretty much half of a show without actually mentioning what the season is all about in the current Western setting, the traditional Christmas period. And of course, Christmas is the time when we think about Jesus being born. You know, it's not the moment of his death, but it's also that new beginning. You know, Jesus's birth is placed 4 days after the winter solstice, and basically on the same day as with winter solstice, if we're looking at a medieval calendar, which was slightly out of sync with the modern calendar. So we have this miracle that in the darkest days of the world, where you know, as archaeologists and historians try to say it so powerfully, and I'm not going to say this literally, but they can't say it literally, but metaphorically, it's actually really beautiful that when the ancient tribes were not sure that the sun would ever rise again, and summer might never happen again, and they had to pray to the gods that it would. You know, but it's a powerful metaphor because specifically, the further north you go, you will find that these are tough times for people. just on a climate point of view. People in northern Scotland suffer from sad syndrome all the time because there's just not enough sunlight there. And they kind of like are looking forward to spring and to rejuvenation and to rebirth and all of those regenerative powers which we were talking about at the beginning of the show. And within the Christian calendar, this is where Jesus is born, the leader of a new message, the leader of a new world, the leader of a new religion, who says, hey, it might be pretty bad right now, but hey, kind of like, you know, it's me. And then obviously within the Christian context, the three magi who come and kind of confirm pretty early on that, yes, this is the one. Apart from a Christian context, what I find very powerful, Kathleen, is in your book, The Poet Prince, where you tally that to goings-on within Renaissance Florence with the birth of Lorenzo and what's happening there. So over to you.
Well, you know, I always think of that Kris Kristofferson song from the 60s and the 70s, said Jesus was a Capricorn. and it always reminds me of some of the fantastically spirited debates and arguments I've had with astrologers about when was Jesus actually born. If you want to see a really, really lively discussion, throw out that question in a room of astrologers and see where it takes you. That none of them will agree on when Jesus' actual birthday was. And there are some very interesting explanations as to why and to how they came to these conclusions. But the one thing that every single person in that room will agree on is that Jesus was not born on the 25th of December and that Jesus was likely not a Capricorn. but, you know, as you know, as many of our listeners know, we've certainly talked about this, much of many Christian traditions and much of the Christmas story is based on or grafted onto ancient legend and ancient tradition in such a way as to make it palatable and enduring for a new audience. And so certainly connecting Jesus to the winter solstice, he is the rebirth. He is the coming of the light. And of course, there's all these connections to the Mithras legends and how those were connected to the winter solstice. There are a lot of different connections, ancient connections to this powerful, reborn, prince-like, prophetic messiah figure who will come and save us during this period of time. And so certainly that is why Jesus would have been sort of ascribed this birthday when, of course, he was not born on the 25th of December, as far as most people believe in the world of astrology. I will say for the record, I believe that Jesus was Pisces, but with a very, very strong Leo leadership and performance ability, because he was a very, very powerful, very charismatic. But I think that the whole thing about him being the prince of the Piscean age, there's some very interesting information about him being born around the 1st of March and why that works. Google Jesus's real birth date and you'll find some interesting stories. I definitely recommend it. But to answer the question that you brought forth is what I discovered in my research as I was writing my fiction series, and specifically feature this idea in my most recent novel, The Poet Prince, about the birth of the Renaissance in Florence, and specifically about the poet prince himself, who is Lorenzo de' Medici, that this idea of magi, who are astrologers, that's what magi are, right? Predicting the coming of very special children based on their potential birth chart and based on the power of the planetary configurations and alignments in a specific age is something that has been going on for 2,000 years. And that there were confraternities of the Magi in Florence. Yes, you know, a lot of the confraternities we see were sort of layman groups where they were doing charitable works, and some of them were boys' clubs, and some of them were very social. But when you dig under the surface, some of these confraternities were extremely powerful. And this particular confraternity of the Magi, which Cosimo de' Medici was a strong supporter of, One of the things that they did was they tracked the birth of children around Tuscany from powerful families to determine who were going to be the ones to watch. And that's sort of the premise of a lot of my book. Lorenzo de' Medici was predicted. His coming was foreseen that he would be the poet prince. He would be born on in a specific birth chart. And in this case, the poet prince is a Capricorn. So this goes back to a very interesting question about was Jesus a Capricorn? Because there is an ancient prophecy, the prophecy of the poet prince, talks about a man who has a Capricorn sun sign, and who has Mars in Pisces or Mars in otherwise in other water signs. So the prophecy of the poet prince actually is very specific about what the astrological chart would look like of someone coming forth and fulfilling this prophecy and having the grace to lead with kindness and compassion, but also with strength. And so I write about it in the book, The Poet Prince, and I write about the fact that in the last 2,000 years, since the death of Jesus, the person who actually best fulfilled that prophecy was, in fact, Lorenzo de' Medici, who arrived perfectly on time on New Year's Day, January 1st, for I want to say 1449, and is it 1449? Yeah. In the middle of the 15th century, he arrives on January 1st, and he has this very specific birth chart. So he arrives, and the Magi predict it. And I also go into this in The Poet Prince because the Magi also predict the coming of the greatest artist of all time, the artist that we know as Michelangelo, who is also born as a Pisces, by the way. And a lot of people don't realize this or don't think about this, but at the time, even then, it was an uncommon thing to name your child something as powerful as Michelangelo, which means, the Archangel Michael. If you're going to name your child after an archangel, there had to have been a reason for it. And one of the things that I uncovered in the folklore of Tuscany when I was writing this book is that he was one of the children, one of the special children who was predicted by the Magi, because his family, the Buonarroti family, actually had very powerful noble and bloodline connections, and they predicted that this child was going to be extremely special. And that's why from the time he is a little boy, 4, 5, 6 years old, he is being watched and immediately is showing artistic talents. So he is cultivated from the time he is born, and his parents named him after the Archangel Michael because he had this auspiciously awaited birth, and he certainly did fulfill his mission to, present extraordinary, beautiful human and divine concepts to us through art. And that was also Lorenzo de' Medici's mission. The poet prince is someone who brings beauty to the world, who restores beauty to the world, but also who brings a new kind of strength. And so I think that even though I don't think necessarily that, I don't think that anymore in the 21st century we're looking for, specific children. Of course, there's lots of talk about indigo children and crystal children and how many special children are being born now, and that's all great. It's not about looking for a messiah or looking for a specific poet prince. Now I think it's about understanding that we are in a place that's very similar to where we were in the Renaissance. We are looking at the opportunity, the same opportunity that Lorenzo de' Medici was looking at, we are looking at. And that opportunity is to step into a new and golden age. It is our opportunity now, here and now, to recreate Renaissance. It is time for us to be reborn again. And we all are a part of that. And we all have the potential and the power to create rebirth for our own reality and for the world that we live in right now.
Absolutely. And it's just to bring that down to very basic and maybe boring things, but also driving home that message, which is the fact that the Renaissance was when a new world was discovered, America was discovered. There are books written about how Florence specifically was extremely important in this discovery, but also the exploration, the knowledge of America even before Columbus set sail. It's also about the fact that the old nobility, the way of doing things with established families, the way it had been done for hundreds of years, came falling apart. It was the merchants, specifically the Medici themselves, who were beginning to rule, who were beginning to take control over. They were the ones who created the banking world. They were the ones, you know, Florence is like the New York of its, or London City of its time. So they created a new world. That world which they created is basically now up for renewal as well. But it is also, I think, very interesting and very important to look at what they did, the message they put forth, and how over the last roughly 500 years, what they did didn't get corrupted as such, but how the big vision didn't get realized. And that is once again, you know, like as the poet Prince identifies, how straight away there are assassination attempts and in the end successful ones on Lorenzo. There's a reason why Jesus died on the cross. There are reasons why, you know, when you are in the middle of certain battles, you get more and more of these things. And just when you look at the last 30 years, you will find that actually political assassinations have come to a radical stop almost. They still happen in some countries for sure, but definitely when you look at the Western world, you will find that they ostracize you. They slap you. Oh, wait, this might ring a bell. They slap sex scandals on you. They try to move you out of the way because they know it's easier and quicker and more effective than trying to orchestrate a Kennedy-like assassination on you. All of this to say that there are these new dynamics, these new ways of where we are at this world, and how you see this newness, this novelty. Unfortunately, this time for all the wrong reasons, but they are being used, and that is something else. So we are again, we're at this threshold. And just to underline something, which is the fact that we kind of think that the Mayans had disappeared as a whole. From the time the Spaniards came, but that's not the case. The Spaniards, you know, suppressed the Mayan world, but the Mayans were always there. And early on in the 15th, in sorry, early on in the 16th centuries, the Mayans were still celebrating these renewal rituals, and they were very powerful. They very much realized that they were going into a time of oppression, which 500 years later they were going to come out of, and that is where we are now. They are coming out of this. So, what is literally known, if you Google it, if you Wikipedia it, there is such a thing known as the Mayan Renaissance, and the 2012 phenomenon is part of that. And the Western world is undergoing a renaissance as well, but because we're in the middle of it, I think quite often we don't really see it.
Well, one of the messages I think that's extremely important here for us today in the 21st century is no more martyrs. No more martyrs. It's a theme of the poet Prince. It is one of the prayers from the Book of Love that I write about, that you know, we pray that one day these teachings will be held in peace and that there will be no more martyrs. The time for that is over. The time for people assassinating leaders and visionaries must be finished. And that is one of my prayers, and that is one of my great prayers. And when I write down my seven prayers for the world today, no more martyrs is going to be my number one prayer. That people who are brave, whether it is Jesus or Martin Luther King, people who are not afraid to tell the truth, people who are not afraid to stand up for what is right and to be a force for change in the world, do not have to suffer anymore. That is one of my prayers, the no more martyr prayer. And even, you know, there's so many different ways to look at it. You and I are currently neck deep in research on Anne Boleyn. Anne Boleyn, one of the most controversial, interesting characters in history, you know, the much maligned and misunderstood queen who loses her head, second wife of Henry VIII, who most people think is a scheming, adulterous, you know, whorish, you know, ambition-laden woman who probably got what was coming to her. And nothing could be further from the truth. When you really dig into who Anne was and what she was doing, this is a woman who is a martyr. She died for her cause, and her cause was bringing the Bible and the Gospels to the common people. her cause was opening up religion and spirituality to people in a way that was not allowed in traditional church. And she learned that from the French heretics who raised her, and she took it to England with her, and they killed her for it. Anne Boleyn is a martyr. And this is what, you know, when I say no more martyrs, we could do shows for the next year on all the people who have been martyred for trying to make a difference and trying to make the world a better place. So I think as we enter the 21st century, this is one of our peace prayers. This is one of our wishes, is that those people who are willing to take a stand and to bring innovation, as you've been talking about earlier, to the people, will not suffer for it, will not be ridiculed for it, and certainly will not die for it.
Absolutely. And I think the man who marks this transition the best in our world, who had to suffer for it but who came out alive and then was able to do it, is actually Nelson Mandela.
Funny.
But Nelson Mandela is this man who had to suffer for it, but they knew that if they killed him, they would have a revolution on their hands. So they put him aside, but actually when the time was right, and with a lot of openness, I always think South Africa is actually, as horrific as it was at the time when the change had to happen, it actually was quite beautiful, the non-violent way and the open way people did allow it to happen. People realized that the time was there and this was the only way it was going to happen without the destruction of South Africa, so to speak. So there are models out there. Things have been proven in the past in places in this world that it can work, that gigantic amounts of transformation can happen. And, Nelson Mandela is definitely one of those people. And again, 2010 was the world of the South Africa World Cup, where Africa finally was not seen as a place of death, of people suffering, of people dying, but also where people could see the great joy which Africa is, unfortunately badly expressed by the vuvuzelas or whatever those instruments were called, but the great African spirit, which is there, the music, the joy of everything which they do. So that was definitely, I think, another thing which everybody keeps going on about 2012 and the Mayan world, but Africa is transforming as well. The world is transforming, the Western world is transforming, and again, we're in the middle of this transformation. And yes, the battle is hard because we're in the middle of it. But there is great hope and there is great progress. It's just sometimes slower than we would like to, or harder to see, again, because we are so preoccupied with the struggle.
Speaking of Africa, I want to kind of transition over to Egypt for a minute. In all of your studies in ancient Egypt, have you come across any specifically solstice traditions regarding ancient Egypt?
Well, I mean, yes is yes and no is the short answer. My dear friend Wim Zitman has written a fantastic book called Egypt: Image of Heaven, which you need to be an astrologer for to truly understand. But basically what Wim has done is shown that the Egyptians didn't do a single thing unless they consulted the astrological chart. Now, their astrological chart was slightly different from the way we are using it. For example, the Egyptians by default only had three seasons. They didn't have four. They were very much originally a lunar tradition rather than a solar tradition. The way they married all of these things, they held an extreme veneration for Sirius. So without going into too much specifics, Sirius was their prime baby. And the sun rising with Sirius was very important. And then they looked what the moon did in cooperation with this. So, and obviously they knew about the solstices. But basically the theme of the Mayan world, whereby we have specific dates which are linked with specific events and saying, on this day we will do something, that same thing was happening in ancient Egypt. The Egyptians realized the importance of dates, what those dates meant, and they made sure that individual decisions and national decisions, if not international decisions, were in agreement with the stars. So the stars dictated what they would do, but it was still a very active process. They just realized that they had to capture the energy and then use that energy to transform and keep Egypt alive. And one of the very beautiful things of the ancient Egyptians is that, and something which archaeologists are seeing, is that gigantic temple complexes of Karnak, when you start digging underneath the stones, slabs of the soil, is that underneath you will find completely intact smaller temples, smaller sanctuaries, which the Egyptians carefully dismantled and buried. Places like Göbekli Tepe is obviously not Egypt, but you will find on occasion that structures were used, and then archaeologists, and we have no reason or no idea why worship or use of this complex was stopped. Well, the answer almost in 99, if not 100% of these cases is astrological, because they felt that this particular period of time had closed off and something new had to happen. And specifically in Egypt, where you have a written tradition and 3,000 years of historical records, you find clear evidence that they demolished something, buried it with reverence, and said, okay, now that's the old time. Now we need to build something new, and this newness is expressed by a new sanctuary. Very much like the Mayans were doing in Chichen Itza, whereby a monument in Chichen Itza was linked with a very specific thing. And, we to some extent still do the same thing. The Millennium Dome in London was a building for the millenniums. Across the world, things were done because it was the millennium. I think the one thing which is missing from a lot of millennium events was the fact that that intent wasn't there. Let's just build something to mark it without any further purpose.
Well, I think that on that note, also, let's remember that this is not just the end of a year. This is the end of a decade. And it's the end of a decade that has been extremely tumultuous. And one of the things that I would throw out to people is think about your life from where you were on Millennium Eve, on that Y2K, evening as we transitioned from 1999 to the year 2000, and where you are now 10 years later. What has happened to you in your life in these 10 years? What has happened to the world in these 10 years? And so for me, when I do my clearing and release process tonight, I'm going to look at all of that. I'm not just going to look at 2010. I'm going to look at this first decade of the new age, because that's what we're really doing. We're coming to a close at the first decade of a new world. So what have we learned? Where do we go? Where does it take us? I think it's actually very exciting if we allow it to be. And I know when I think about, where I was 10 years ago, I'm not even on the same planet that I was on the eve of the coming of the new millennium. So I think that's a really important and interesting thing to contemplate as we sit here at the end of 2010.
Absolutely. Where were you on Millennium Eve, and look at the world. Again, there was no internet radio. We wouldn't have been here. There really wasn't any Wi-Fi. There wasn't anything which we so take for granted these days. There's such a different world out there, and we have undergone so much change. I often tell the story of my grand, who both of them, unfortunately, one grand died this week. So, but they lived until their 90s, and when I looked at how they grew up, and the world they functioned in, and the world they died in, was so different. And I always kind of felt like, remote controls, kind of like, for TVs, how does that work? Steam things for doing your clothing with, washing machines, all of these things simply did not exist when they grew up. But that how as big as those changes were, for that generation, they were relatively slow. The washing machine kind of had one decade, and the TV had another decade. Now it's development upon development upon development, and quite often the development is obsolete by the time it's released, because TV is already announcing, the news is already announcing something else. So the pace of change which we're going through is so fast. 2012 was the year, and still is the year, when Terence McKenna called the singularity, when there was so much novelty, so many new things happening at such an incredible speed of pace, that the the theoretical model, and it's a theory, it's like climate change. It's all based on computer things, and kind of like what happens is always different from what a computer will tell you. But basically, the way the theory worked was there is so much novelty happening that almost every second something new will happen. And basically, this will kind of like create an explosion, if you want, of novelty, whereby a what he called the singularity would happen. And whereas I don't think a singularity will happen, it is the case that almost every second the world changes.
Another just a, kind of a final shout out here to our friend John Major Jenkins. You mentioned his book earlier, his books earlier, but his work on this idea of 2012 and the Mayan calendar and astronomy and is phenomenal. His book Mayan Cosmogenesis will blow your mind and make you very excited if you love these subjects. So definitely want to leave you with that. That's a great Christmas present for yourself. Check out John's work.
Absolutely, and he has another one which is just out in paperback, I think, or has been out in paperback for the last few weeks, which is called The 2012 Story. And The 2012 Story is slightly more accessible. It's slightly more not readable, but slightly less academic is probably the best way of describing it. It's got more words and less calculations and less juggling with fates. And in fact, I think you should probably, because they are so good, you should make it a package. And give both of them to your dear ones.
So, I wish all of you a very, very blessed solstice. I hope that your own reflections on the last decade are full of insights for you. I entreat you all to spend some time meditating, being introspective, reading, resting. Give yourself a break this holiday season. Don't give in into the frantic pace and be in harmony with nature and chill out a little bit. And that is my wish for all of you. I'm going to start working on my lists tonight for my solstice ritual. And until next week, the truth against the world.
Merry Christmas!
And happy solstice!